Scorpions Avenue.
Hey.
Hey.
What'd you think?
About what?
Did you get my text?
Oh.
Hi, I'm Patton Oswalt.
I'm Meredith Salinger.
Welcome to the 50th episode of Did You Get My Text? And you know what? For our 50th episode, I say, you know who I want on the show because I'm such a film nerd?
You say, you know who you want on the show?
I want a great director.
Oh, yes.
I want a great director. So I called Martin Scorsese, and he gave me Ben Stiller's info. And that is our guest today.
Ben Stiller,
thank you so much for being on the show.
Scorsese and I are, you know, we're tight.
really
tight. He's
got
your info.
Yeah.
He's got your info to get
you on speed dial.
We hang a lot. We watch movies and we break them down.
Does Marty like to watch movies? I've never gotten that indication from him. He likes movies.
He's a bit of a fan.
Ben,
hi.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome.
I'm so happy to be with you guys.
Yeah. We're so happy cool. You're here all the way from New York City.
He is in Manhattan in the middle of May. Is the weather nice? It's got to be gorgeous right now, right?
It's so great today. Oh, it's so amazing. So it's been winter for about 12 months here.
Yeah.
And it just literally like a week ago, finally somebody realized it's spring because the trees have, I go through this every year, having been from New York and also having lived here for the last 12 or 13 years. Mm-hmm. That period when the leaves come back, you really get to a point where you just start to wonder, are they actually going to come back this year?
Right.
Is it going to happen?
Yeah.
And this year it took longer. It took like 2 or 3 weeks longer, I'm sure, than last year. And it was weird.
Yeah, we were just in New York. What was it, 2 weeks ago or three weeks ago? And have you been in the Meatpacking District or the West Village, wherever it is, to the little island?
I love that area.
The little island, that new thing that Bloomberg built, those like... Have you been there?
With all the like the Botero sculptures?
Yeah, they're
and
like
stuff?
In the ocean. They're like in the river. Or is that a river?
It's like the new High Line.
Oh, that. Oh, that thing. Oh, that crazy new park.
Yes.
Yeah, it's so amazing. I just went there and it's beautiful and incredible and a feat of architecture. And you should go because it's cool. There's an amphitheater.
Yeah, I drive by it all the time. I love it. Yeah, it's like a weird sort of like a cantilevered sort of type of thing.
There's like separate little concrete pods, but they like made it beautiful and turned it into a park.
They reclaimed something ruined and abandoned like the High Line and made it actually genuinely cool. You wouldn't believe it. It's as nice as it is, and it's really nice.
Yeah, that area is really great. I love that. It's one of my favorite neighborhoods in New York.
So let's name your other 20 favorite neighborhoods, starting with number... Ben, here's what we're going to do, because you're...
That's my podcast. I have my own podcast, Ben's 20 Favorite Neighborhoods.
Ben's 20 Favorite Neighborhoods for each city. And he has for each city.
It's a different
city.
Episode for each neighborhood and city.
Yeah. My God, writer, director, actor, producer, I mean, they're... Your career, and you're still young at it, is so far-ranging. So what I've decided to do, here's my interview technique. We're going to start off with Severance, but I'm going to use that to connect to how a lot of your early career led to the stuff that you're doing with Escape at Dannemora and Severance
as a director.
Because, my God,
Escape
in
at Dannemora, I just have to stop. There's one scene
yes.
in Escape from Dannemora where I literally was like, this is the best directed scene
I've ever seen
in my life.
Really?
Oh my God.
The scene where Benicio Del Toro and is he with Paul? They're just walking. And it's a long shot and it's on them and you see, and you just stay on them while they're walking. And Benicio Del Toro, you can see every single emotion. And it's like the best.
Well, It's a well acted scene.
It's a very well acted scene, but it's a very well directed scene.
It's two things. It is brilliantly acted. You can see every decision that Benicio's character is making as he's walking around that suburban neighborhood. But the fact that you had the confidence to lay back and say, let's let this happen and just observe it going on. The fact that the direction becomes so non-flashy is what pulls you in, because there's nothing else to look at but Benicio. I remember that we rewound that scene to watch it again. To go, did we just see what we saw? You can literally figure out every single thing he's doing, and it's because you said, I'm cool enough to lay back and just let this happen.
It was brilliant.
My
well, I think that, well, thank you. But I think, you know, what that was about is just sort of the staying out of the way of the actors a lot of the time.
Yes.
Which I think as a director, you should, but, you know, if you have really great actors.
Except there's a lot of directors that don't know how to do that. They can't help themselves.
Well, that does happen.
Yeah.
That does happen. And as an actor myself, you know, I've had that experience with directors where you sometimes, and I think actors are very sensitive to that too. Mm-hmm. When you're even when working with like someone, Benicio, where we knew each other over the years, but never worked together, that, you know, there's that period where you're just like trying to sense what is the director going to be like? Are they going to let me do my thing? Are they mm-hmm. going to give me encouragement? Are they going to be weird? You know, it's all, you just don't know what that relationship is yep. going to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, and as actors, we're all very vulnerable. So, you know, I feel sensitive to that when I'm directing, because I know what that feels like as an actor.
See, that's got to be such an advantage that you have. You know the moments, because you can remember if he or she had just left me alone for the scene, it would have been even better. And you can remember that and bring that to these moments of let's just let this happen and see where it goes.
Yeah. And actually, you know, that scene and a couple of other scenes, it was actually the cinematographer I worked with, Jessica Lee Gagne, who I worked with on Dan Amore and also Severance.
Yep.
You know, she once said to me, and we met on Dan Amore, we met and decided to do that project together. So I hadn't worked with her before. And one day we were shooting a scene and I yelled cut, and she came over to me. She said, you know, you yell cut too early. And I was like, what? She's like, well, just why don't you let it go a little longer? And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And that scene in particular where Benicio and Paul are walking, that was, you know, that was a specific choice that we made. But there really is something interesting if you kind of don't yell cut immediately and just let some stuff happen, because you never know. You know, sometimes something great happens. Sometimes, you know, an actor says, why are you still rolling? You know, whatever it is, but it's just, it kind of allows for space for, you know, something to occur.
Now, you were making film. You had a, just like me, you had a Super 8 camera, and you were growing up in Manhattan, right? When you were started shooting stuff.
Yeah. I was growing up on the Upper West Side, and my parents, you know, were actors, Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira, and they were doing their comedy act, and we were in the heart of their world of show business. And, but New York, you know, New York show business in the 70s, which was kind of,
my God,
it was a little, you know, it was like more tactile and little, it wasn't the glossy Hollywood thing. We loved going out to LA as kids. I loved it to be able to go out when they would do something in LA, but in New York it was, Upper West Side. It was, my dad got me a Super 8 camera. And he was always shooting Super 8 footage. He was shooting home movies all the time of us.
Yeah, so you had the background of 70s showbiz, but also you had 70s New York, which visually is never going to be recreated. I think I was tweeting about that movie, The Seven Ups, and you said, oh, you like tweeted to me that, because the background that they had, that is never coming back. The way New York looked in those years is gone.
Oh my God.
It's just that crazy.
And the way that people would, it's just so, I mean, it was, I guess, a period where the city kind of went into a little bit of a decay, you know, and things sort of, you know, were not doing the best economically. And it was, of course, before all of this urban renewal, whatever it is, building that's happened, especially in the last 20 years. And I'm watching it happen in the Upper West Side now too. But those, for me, just those streets and the way they would shoot sequences back then in action movies was so, it was, you know, they didn't always cordon off the streets.
No.
You know, a lot of times, right? So they're doing like a car chase.
Yeah.
And you see people in the background going, like, looking like, what the hell? Just what's going on?
Yeah.
You know, they just would do it.
Oh.
You know, and so, to watch that sequence, particularly in that, that's like a weird lost movie of the 70s, The Seven Ups.
Yeah. But it was, it's weird how that kind of, that kind of filmmaking philosophy sort of infuse itself into you, because you were acting and directing kind of parallel with each other all along. I mean, was it directing first or acting first, or were they just always in parallel? How did that kind of work for you?
Yeah, they were always kind of like competing inside of me, honestly. Like as a kid, I loved directing. I loved the idea of being a director and being a cinematographer. And I was very much about sort of like making of movies, you know, like if there was like the Jaws Log, you know, with Carl Gottlieb wrote about the making of Jaws. Book.
Oh my God. Just the idea that he had to wake up every morning and Spielberg's like, I need you to write like 10 new pages for what? For today. You need to rewrite the scenes for today. we're going out in an hour. Write this stuff right now.
That movie is just like, for me, it's sort of like the Holy Grail. It's just like everything kind of comes out of that movie. And, you know, and just to study how that movie was made because Spielberg, especially on that film, was such like he was creating almost a new genre, you know?
Yeah.
And that is a lot of direct, you know, to read about that kind of stuff. Like, oh, that can happen. Like they can come up with something new, you know, because I think directing is so much about adjusting in the moment and thinking about what's going on, looking at what's going on and seeing how it differs from what's on the page and what you need it to be, or, you know, all that is just adjustments that are happening in real time. And so when you see that's how somebody did that in a movie that you love, you go, oh, okay, I guess that's, you know, that's how you do it. That's what you can do that.
And now, was it a big deal for you that your film debut is a Spielberg film?
What?
Yeah.
What?
It was, I mean,
Empire of the Sun.
Yeah.
So you got to work with Spielberg.
I had
Spielberg.
A small part.
Yeah.
I had a small part, but it was very exciting because I had a small part in a play that moved to Broadway. And then I got a part in this other movie with my dad, actually called Hot Pursuit with John Cusack, I hesitate to mention it because now people, but it's pretty funny because my dad and I are playing drug runners.
I wonder what it's like to make your film debut with John Cusack. I wonder what that's like. It's like Meredith. Weird. Is
the Journey of Natty Gann.
Right. Oh my God.
That wasn't my film.
So we kind of share that.
We kind of do.
Then.
My first movie though was Annie with John Huston.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
John Huston, John Cusack, you know, all the good Johns.
But how many days did you get to be on Empire of the Sun and watch Spielberg at work? Did you try to do a version of shadowing him, even though you were young and it was a small part? Like, what did you get to experience?
Oh yeah. 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 Well, first of all, he hired me having seen this play and he didn't ask me to audition.
Nice.
Which blew my mind.
Oh my
that was
God.
Incredible. Yeah. I had a meeting with him and he said, yeah, I think you'd be right for this part. And then I went away and my agent said, yeah, they want you to play this part.
Wait, how old are you at this time? Are you?
I was probably 21.
Good Lord.
And we got to play prisoners of war in this this Japanese prison camp. And John Malkovich was sort of the ringleader of our group. And there's a couple of other actors, an actor named David Neidorf. And we were all there for a couple of months in Spain. They built built a prison camp outside of Seville. And it was incredible. Every day we come to work. And he didn't know what he was going to shoot specifically involving us. So we would kind of hang out and just be ready to go, you know, and we also had to get skinny because we were, you know, in the prison camp, which sort of like I showed up really skinny to the point where he said, are you okay? Because he asked me if I could lose some weight. I was like,
You told me to lose weight.
Yeah. You stop eating.
Then, but then we were all hanging out and there was like a great craft service buffet.
God.
So by the end of the shoot, we all kind of had gotten back to our normal weight. But it was so much fun because, you know, it was also pre-CGI, really. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, he was doing this Mustang raid of these American, you know, P-51s coming in and they were real planes mixed with also model airplanes too. I mean, there were cutouts of airplanes on the runway in the deep background, you know, two-dimensional cutouts to make it look like there were more. I mean, it was old school movie making still. And it was every day was so much fun. And he was so generous too. He would, you know, I had made a short film that I had gotten on Saturday Night Live that there was a takeoff on The Color of Money.
That was going to be my next question. That was before Empire of the Sun?
I had made it. I'd made it around that time. I'm not sure if I'd actually, I think I'd gotten it. I don't think I'd gotten it on SNL at that point. I might have already. It was 86, 87. And he, I gave it to him. He watched it and he, you know, gave me feedback. So, you know, it was great. He was very, very generous.
That movie, The Hustler of Money, it's called The Hustler of Money. And it was, again, with that guerrilla style filmmaking, you're doing House of Blue Leaves with John Mahoney. And
the great John Mahoney.
Yeah. And you basically said, wait a minute, I have this cast. I've got this idea. Let's just scrap together and get this film made because I just want to make a movie. And as funny as a film as it is, it was that it was a really early indication for how you tend to focus and obsess on things and get every little detail of the thing that you're parodying right. And you really nailed the idea of the movie that's openly going for an Oscar. Like, just give us an Oscar. We deserve it. And it's a shadow critique of sometimes a great actor and director and writer come together and it maybe doesn't work. And it, it was such a ballsy thing to do at that time. You would, you're just making your debut and you're like, Scorsese, you know, sometimes he doesn't nail it. Like, whoa, my God, this was, it was, it's an amazing piece of filmmaking.
Well, it was just an idea. And I made it with two friends, Ralph Howard and Steve Klayman. And we were like, Ralph and I were writing stuff at that time. And and we were like, yeah, this could be a funny take. I don't think we, you know, we were like, this could be a funny parody, you know, like what if it was about bowling instead of pool. And, it, and you know, it was more like a home movie where I got everybody in my family to be in it. My grandfather's in it. My girlfriend was in it. You know, everybody was in it. And but I wouldn't have made that little and that was and I did it with my own money. We ended up selling it to Saturday Night Live and they put it on the air, which was just like it blew my mind at that time. And but I wouldn't have made that little short if I hadn't have done this other thing with John Mahoney when we were doing The House of Blue Leaves, which was a play by John Guare that was running it off Broadway. And then it moved to Broadway and ended up winning Tonys. And John was incredible.
Yeah,
and
as it, always.
And Susie Kurtz and Julie Haggerty and Chris Walken was in that production too.
What?
It was, he was in the original production at Lincoln Center. And but John was just, he was such a good person and such a friend to me when I was starting out. And he was so funny. He was such a great actor. He had this really ridiculous sense of humor where he just would make fun of himself all the time. And I had this idea. He'd got nominated and won a Tony. He was, you know, he was the star of this show. And I had this idea to do a documentary about him backstage called John Mahoney, A Portrait of the Artist as an Old Man. And like the idea was like he was this horrible alcoholic and was mean to everybody backstage. But then on stage, you know, everybody loved him and he was winning awards. And so I did it with a video camera backstage and I edited it at home on two VHS machines.
Oh, and primitive.
Yeah, it was that thing where you're recording off of one. And then I showed it at a party. It was like a New Year's party that I think my parents had and everybody was there. And it got laughs and people like loved it. And it was that moment. And I'd already been doing this since I was a kid. But like that moment was, oh, wow, this is really fun to make something that people laugh at and they get it. And that sort of and it was because John had just said, yeah, I'll be the star of your thing. And like literally like we filmed him with like a wino bag and bottle asleep under the poster of his Tony Award winning performance, you know, on like 52nd Street and Broadway. You know, he would do anything. He just was, he was so great. So that was really what led to that. And then John was, you know, obviously he was in that short too.
Yeah.
And, he was I miss him so much because he was such an amazing person.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, there's so many things to talk about and how you started and everything. Let's take a quick break and we will be right back.
Hey, we're back. And when we last left young Ben, he had just made The Hustler of Money, which, amazingly, Lorne Michaels. How did it get into Lorne Michaels' hands?
John Lovitz gave it to him.
Oh, my God, John Lovitz.
Wow.
And I wasn't even friends with John Lovitz, but he had come to see The House of Blue Leaves. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to him because, you know, I guess at that time I was like wanting to figure out how I could get my stuff going. And when I think back now, it's like, I called up this guy. I didn't really know John Lovitz, who was very established, actor and funny guy.
He was famously the breakout star of his first season of SNL. Like he was the guy they kept.
Yeah. And he and a lot of people came backstage to see this play, House of Leaves, because it was like a celebrated production. I had a little part in it. But so every night there would be a different, you know, celebrity would come back. And he came and I asked him, I said, hey, I got this short. Would you think you could get it into SNL? And he literally met me in the lobby of 30 Rock. And I gave him this VHS or like a 3/4 inch copy of it. And he brought it up and he said, all right, you know, they'll call you or whatever. And then like a day later, I got a call. They were going to put it, it was like on a Friday. They said they're going to put it on that Saturday.
Good
and
God.
And then did you start working? And then did you do stuff, more stuff for them after
he
that?
He did a season of SNL.
Oh, right.
Well, okay. I did 6 weeks. I did a very short period of time.
Okay.
But I first, what they did was they invited me to like, to audition and to give them a writing sample. And so, I made an audition tape where I did some characters and, yeah. And then gave them some writing and then they hired me as an apprentice writer and featured player, which was exciting, but you know, it was also very daunting because I really, you know, wasn't that comfortable as a, like as a live sketch performer. I didn't have a lot of experience doing that.
Did you go to college? Did you go to directing school? Did you, how did you become, how do you know how to be, or you were just doing it on your own and it was just happening? So you just learned you go?
I wanted to go to directing school. I wanted to go to USC film school.
Yeah.
And I did not get in because I didn't have the grades or the whatever it took to get in. And then I went to UCLA, but at the time UCLA's film school didn't start till the junior year. So I started as an acting major and that goes back to the acting directing thing. I was kind of like, sort of like going between both and not really knowing
both directions, man.
Yeah. And which could, you know, sometimes it was great. And then because I create my own stuff when I wasn't getting hired, but eventually, you know, it's just an interesting thing. I've always still to this day kind of, you know, think about and try to balance and figure out. But so then I quit UCLA really quickly after about 9 months. I went back to New York and just started taking acting classes. So it was really, I started pursuing the acting thing more. And then it sort of led to, not getting work at all. So then making my own stuff.
Wow.
A lot of auditions and not getting stuff and bad auditions.
But
too,
then the directing,
being bad at auditions.
The directing, you just figured it out on your own. Did you read about it?
It was like reading books like the Jaws Log or you know, a subscription to American Cinematographer or, you know, just watching movies and then being on sets. I think as actors, we get to work with directors.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the one thing directors don't really get to do is to see other directors work. So, you know, for us as actors, we get to experience what we feel works for us. And you know, you can ask questions and you can watch, you know, I got to go watch my mom on the set of Fame. So I got to see,
loved that movie so much.
You got to meet Alan Parker and see how he made movies.
Yeah.
Because that guy is so underrated in terms of, I think he famously said, I want to make one film in every genre. Like, I want to do a horror movie, Angel Heart. I want to do a musical. Like, he wanted to try to conquer each genre. It was his approach to directing.
Yeah, I think he was a great director. He just passed away recently. He was an amazing director. You know, Fame is a really great movie.
It's one of my favorites.
He did a lot of different genres, but there was like, there's something about his kind of filmmaking that I think relates to, even though he did different genres, there was a consistency. I mean, he did Bugsy Malone too. Right?
Also another favorite. Love that movie.
Amazing.
But there's a consistency to the reality level in these movies and visually they're beautiful and visceral and real. And I don't know, there's a certain thing that was like about the filmmaking that he came out of later 70s into the 80s, but early 70s filmmaking, which was like, we don't care what the genre is. Okay, it's a comedy, it's an action thing, whatever, but it's going to have a reality to it that, you know, that is consistent. And so anyway, I got to watch him do that on the set. And, you know, it was by osmosis, I think, a lot of it. They're just, you know, loving being around it.
You just did a more modern version of what all the 70s movie brats did, which is, where'd you go to film school? I just watched a lot of movies until I picked it up.
Right.
And also, Scorsese, I think, went to NYU, but was lucky enough to have a professor that said, well, you know, the studio system's collapsing. If you don't show up with your own script, you're not going to direct today. No one's going to assign you movies anymore. Those years are over. show up with something. And so you clearly kind of took that ethos with you as well. You know,
yeah, I don't think that's changed. I mean, I think you have to know what you want to do, and you have to have your own. If you can't, you know, if you can't write on your own, you have to work with somebody and figure it out. Because to me, writing has always been about getting to the film, you know, like writing something that is just and it's collaborating with writers. Though there is something special, actually talking to Chris Rock about this, the idea of writing by yourself, just things that will come out, even if it's not your where you feel your strength, there's just something that will come out that is much more personal. And, you know, but I also love collaborating.
Yes.
Because I want to work with a writer who's better than I am, who can, you know, imagine something in a way that, you know, that I can see it maybe in my head, but I don't know how to get there on the page. And that process, I love. I love that.
Yeah. You do take risk and you do big changes. I was at very early table reads for Tropic Thunder when it was a significantly different film. It was still hilarious, but there were different approaches to the characters. And I remember Keanu Reeves was reading your part, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Then you kept changing.
He was great. He was amazing,
he was
too.
So good. But then you realize, actually, there's a much broader Dr. Strangelove satire to be had about Hollywood in this that we could really go to town with. And then later on, I went to the other table read where Tom Cruise was there, and then you were playing you, and so it was two distinctly different films, and both brilliant, but you're like, we can go bigger with this.
Yeah, well, you know, Tom came up with the idea of that character that he played. He literally came up with that idea.
Really?
Yeah, because at one point I had talked to him about playing the role I played, and he said, you know, well, you don't, there's no studio executive in this movie. You're making fun of all these other, you know, sort of archetypes. And it changed the whole, and this was like three or four months before we started shooting the movie. And it literally changed the entire plot, but it was such a good idea. And Justin Theroux, you know, and I were like, oh, this is, and that really sparked Justin, who went and wrote the first draft of all those Les Grossman scenes.
Yes.
And But it, you know, that was also something that I think you talk about, like being open to, changes, being open to the process, and really making choices when you think, okay, this is worth it. This is worth exploring and taking, you know, and maybe just walking away from something we've been wed to the whole time. Because that idea of Tom playing that part, not only did I think, oh, well, that would be so much fun to watch him be that guy, but it was also story-wise, it was an aspect of the story that we hadn't even explored. Like, what's going on back in the States while these guys are out in the jungle?
Yeah, there was a whole thing he riffed at that table read that I thought was so great. But again, the movie was so top heavy with great comedic bits that didn't make it into the movie, where they're doing, it's a very early video conference call where the technology was still really janky, and he's trying to move the camera around. He's going, who is talking? Like, he can't figure out who he's supposed to be pointing the camera at. And it made me laugh so hard, because that is so what that generation did. Thought video conferencing was like, it needs to be, who is talking to me? And it was so funny and awkward. But again, it shows you how dense you guys made the script, that you could lose a bit like that because there were a million other great things in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's always good to have more stuff than you need. Well,
yeah.
Was Reality Bites like one of your first big directing? Was that one of, I remember auditioning for you for Reality Bites.
You did.
I did audition.
I feel like I remember that. I don't remember a lot of things. I remember moments, but I know we met back then.
I auditioned for you, and I specifically remember it because I remember exactly what I was wearing, because I was wearing this like crocheted black top, and it had like weight to it. And there was a moment in the script or something in the audition, and I had to get up really fast, but like the shirt had its own, and I stood, it had its own inertia when I said, like, the shirt went up, and I was like, oh my God, like my shirt. Anyway,
like you flashed everybody?
I don't think it like necessarily flashed as much as it sort of like almost did. And then I was sort of mortified. And anyway, but yeah,
I don't remember that.
Good. Okay. Well, I do.
But that was a movie that you really had to raise money to make it. You put stuff on the line to get that done, right? That was...
No, I mean, no. Reality Bites was... I was hired to direct Reality Bites. Helen Childress wrote it.
Oh.
And Danny DeVito and Michael Shamberg and Stacey Scher were the producers. Mm-hmm. And they were... And they had this idea. And I came in and met Helen, who was writing about her life. And Helen and I connected, and we started to sort of work on the script and develop it. And for me, I felt so outside of the experience that, you know, that her character, Lelaina, was having, because I grew up sort of, you know, New York, Upper West Side.
Yeah,
I felt
like,
oh, I'm like this guy, the MTV guy, or the in-your-face TV guy.
Uh-huh.
And that's the character that I understand. Also having, you know, worked at MTV too. And just so I kind of like came at it from that point of view. I said, well, if I could play that guy, we could. And we started to improvise together, Helen and I. And she actually just recently sent me some tapes of us improvising back in like 19, whatever, 92 or three scenes between Michael and Lelaina. It was so much fun to listen to after all those years. But she was great because she was like really, again, in that process of like being open to me coming in and saying, well, I kind of like want to come at it from this point of view, which I thought was important because the Lelaina and Troy and Michael, you know, sort of, you know, love triangle.
Yes.
I felt it was important that the character that wasn't Ethan Hawke, at least, you know, was something that she should consider, you know?
Well,
and like we worked at that in the script to try to make it like, okay, this actually should be a decision, even though she's going to end up with the cool guy.
Yeah. You really, for a while, you really leaned into what like Albert Brooks did, which is, if there's something that I see that's wrong or annoying in society, instead of playing the character who points it out, I'm going to embody what is bad about a certain thing. So I was working at MTV at the time, working on the movie awards. I think that's where we started working together.
Right.
And my God, did you nail that? And that there's that certain MTV executive energy that makes other people around them tired because they are so driven and they have that horrible, and I know this is long a white whale of yours, that Sammy Glick energy that, boy, did you nail that, where you're like, although out of nowhere in Reality Bites when Ethan Hawke comes out on the street and your character's been such a dick up to that point, but you totally nail the, then what are you doing out here? What are you looking for out here? Like, yes, right, your character is this driven dick, but he also knows exactly what's going on. He wouldn't be in the position he's in if he couldn't read people. And it was this such a shocking moment where you're like, he just totally saw through Ethan Hawke's bullshit, you know, cool Gen X pose. And just,
yeah, I think the insecurity too is important, that this guy also, you know, was confident in who he was and kind of living off of that. And kind of, that's what his, how like that energy you talk about where he's kind of go, and you're just going to keep on sort of like moving forward. And I don't, you know, even know what I'm saying, but I'm saying it because I believe that if I keep talking, it's going to make something happen.
Yes.
Right. Oh, but then there's also an insecurity too, that he wanted to be, you know, Troy. He wanted, I felt that was really important, that, you know, because like, you know, I want to be the cool Ethan Hawke guy with the hair and the, you know, and goatee or whatever. So, you know, that was important, I think, in balancing, hopefully, that you see like, oh, these people are all, you know, real human beings who have, you know, insecurities also.
Oh, the frailty. I mean, your character in Heavyweights, which I love Judd Apatow, and that.
Well, he had a lot of insecurities. Well,
oh, yes. He had many insecurities. But that was
Tony Perkins.
Oh, my God. But that's one of those characters where you're like, it almost hurt the movie. Like, can we just follow this maniac? This is like, I want to see what his daily life is. And I was happy that when you did Dodgeball, Christian White is almost a mutant version of Tony. And we see his whole story up until the end credits when we came back for those reshoots where you've become morbidly obese.
Yes, White Goodman.
White Goodman. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's
but,
right.
But here's these, yeah, because these are very deep layered characters.
Oh, God.
And a lot of work went into the backstory for both of them. No, I mean, first of all, the whole thing of Heavyweights is just that, you know, first of all, Judd was making this movie, you know, it's like we were all in our 20s,
yeah,
and Disney was handing over a movie to him, and you know, Judd was like, this would be funny to have this like sadistic counselor, you know, never in a million years would this ever get close to Disney or Disney Plus. You know, it wouldn't even make anything streaming or whatever, a YouTube channel. I mean, it was just like, you know, we just thought, oh, this will be funny, and they kind of let us go and do it.
Oh.
But very politically incorrect.
Oh,
and
boy.
Also, But, you know, but also funny because, you know, it's like if a crazy guy like that was in charge of a camp like this, that's what would happen.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. But I think, you know, it was just a different time in terms of comedies where you could just go for it. Oh. And
right. Even in Tropic Thunder with Robert Downey Jr.'s character. Like,
well, early on in the very early version of the script, that first tape read, it was an African-American actor. That guy, Harry, what was his name? He's in everything.
Harry Lennox?
Harry Lennox.
Yeah, Hugh.
And he's playing the Robert Downey Jr. part, but what he's playing is he's post-surgery or post-whatever he's done to himself, and when his character got really angry, then he would slip into the Australian accent, and you realize, oh, no, this is a white guy who's made himself look like Harry Lennox. It was a whole other level of weirdness, but again, you guys went, let's go even further with this. Which was amazing.
And I mean, and obviously today it would be much more complicated to even get the movie off the ground if possible. Yeah. But, you know, but having Robert, you know, I thought there were two or three actors who really that were on the list that sort of ended after that, who I thought could actually pull that off because the audience would understand what they were doing.
Yes.
And, you know, and where that character was coming, because it was purely making fun of actors who take themselves seriously. And
I mean,
Downey was such a good actor, I felt, and that he could go there in a way that people would buy it because of his commitment to it.
Yes. Yeah, it was incredible. I think we need to take another quick break, and we will be right back. Now I have, like, every time you answer something, it
brings
I have,
up
like, eight other questions
because
you've done so much.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and
right
we'll be right
back.
Okay.
Hey, everybody, we're back with Ben Stiller. This is so exciting.
I want to go back now. We're gonna loop around like Tarantino a little bit.
Let's bring the room down a little bit.
Because if you watch The Hustler of Money, that is much. It's a lot like to the Ben Stiller show. That is the 1948 show or the Goon show. That's the prototype for what your show would become. Very, very specific. In fact, The Hustler of Money is almost a rough draft for A Few Good Scouts. That sketch, which is even more. Absolutely nailing on the head the Oscar craving movie. I think you even call it from Oscar craving productions.
Oscar craving productions.
And again, as funny as it is, there are shots the shot coming down of the flagpole at dawn that there's beautiful cinema in this, as goofy as they're being. They're nailing all of the filmic elements perfectly. So, like, how much did that? And again, talk about a dream cast, not just the cast. But then the writers. So you've got Odenkirk, Janine, Andy Dick in front of the camera, behind the camera, writing Odenkirk, Janine, David Cross. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, Dino Stamatopoulos. And Jeff Kahn was writing on it. It was all, you know, for me, it was so much about, like, okay, we're going to do the parody of this movie, and it's going to be, you know, Cape Fear, but it's Eddie Munster, but we're going to make it look like Cape Fear. And as a director, I was obsessed with that and excited by that. Mm-hmm. I think Odenkirk and those guys were more like, oh, let's actually make it funny. And I was like, and you know, they were worried about the. I was into the writing too, but I was really more about, okay, like, you know, what is it going to look like? And to me, that was part of the humor. And I think that's why we all enjoyed working together.
Yes.
Everybody sort of had their own area and that they got into. And Manson, I think, was like,
my God.
You know, and that's a pure Odenkirk sketch.
Right.
And, you know, character. But for me, shooting that was so much fun to really get into, like, okay, we're going to make this look like Lassie, the Andy Griffith show or whatever.
Yes.
And, you know, but we were, you know, it was a 6 month period of time and whatever it was, 92. And, you know, we all were like, you know, just kind of doing it. And then, you know, and then we were canceled, but it was so much fun. It took us a while to get it on the air.
Yeah.
But then, and then when we finally got on the air, we were kind of like also Judd, you know, had never run a show. We didn't know what we were doing. Mm-hmm. It was his instincts as a showrunner were there from the beginning in terms of the way he would battle with the studio and the network and really, like, demand, you know, no, you got to give us this, or you have to give us that, or this is what makes it funny when they give us notes, because what we were doing was so out there.
Again, it got back to, you would obsess on these things. The whole, Scotty from Star Trek, and the do it character, the guy that is just so focused, and Casey Kasem. Right. And I know that you told me the network was like, why would they, but who does do people know? But we do, and our enthusiasm will come through. That's what's funny about the sketch. It like let us have this. I just love that.
We're trying to go off of what we were into, and
yeah,
you know, the James Doohan episode was just, you know, I was a huge Star Trek fan, and he said yes, and so we just said, all right, let's just lean into the fact that I, you know, I'm a huge Star Trek nerd. And it was no acting involved. I was as so excited.
Just bothering that poor guy. Yeah. I mean,
but yeah.
And also it's the classic story, literally a classic timeline. They get this show on the air. This is if the internet had existed the way it did now, Ben Stiller's show would still be on the air because the fans of that show were cultists, basically. We could recite lines, B-minus, time traveler, just all the lines. Then Fox cancels it, then it wins the Emmy for best writing. After it's been canceled, it wins the Emmy.
Yeah, so like I think Freaks and Geeks and all the good shows that get canceled and are still amazing.
And I think there's a great, isn't there a morning show interview with you guys after you've won the Emmy and you're clearly drunk or a couple of you are boozed up and you're just like, the network, like you're just ripping on, it's so glorious. It's such a great piece of film.
I think we were all just sort of, I don't know what was going on. I mean, even when I look at like the speech and I got up there and like sort of like saying like, hey Fox, you missed something. We just didn't know what was going on. Except, yeah, and we were all so surprised. And I also, like, at that point, you know, who knows? Like, that's the only Emmy I ever won. I was like, that was amazing, you know, at that time. But you're young and you're just like, okay, that was great. You know, what are we going to do now?
Yeah.
You know, but I think we did appreciate it. Like, that's the thing. We did appreciate it in the moment because it was so unexpected.
Right.
And even when we got canceled, we weren't upset. You know, I mean, we were disappointed, but it was sort of like, all right, we had this amazing shot and everybody kind of just, you know, went on to the next thing.
What's so interesting to me is it seems, especially with Odenkirk and everyone, but you especially, like you start with such great comedic material and work and directing and acting. And then all these amazing comedy people turn out the most beautiful, sensitive, incredible performances and move into this dramatic area that's so deep. And I guess Walter Mitty starts that really deep descent into major drama. But like Escape from Dannemora and Severance, and they're so incredibly dramatic, incredibly cinematic. All of them are incredibly cinematic.
Walter Mitty is just...
Walter Mitty...
I hate to use the word painterly, because that sounds so pretentious, but there are painterly shots in that film that you must... I mean, it was clear that when we were in Iceland, but even in the way you shoot Manhattan, it looks like a heightened, more gorgeous Manhattan, even though it's modern-day Manhattan. I don't know how you got the angles that you did. You're clearly looking at the city in a different way than other people are. But, you know,
Man. I mean, first of all, I love that we're in that movie together and I love our scenes together and I love you in that movie. Seriously, because you exude so much. There's such an amazing warmth that you exude. I'm just so happy that we did that together. Wow. You know, for me, there was like this, an image in my head of what this thing was that Steve Conrad had written, who's just an amazing writer. Mm-hmm. And Steve, you know, figured out this tone for it, but there's this heightened tone. And, you know, a lot of that is just like looking for me was looking at movies that I loved about New York. And, you know, I thought about Tootsie a lot, which I think is one of the great New York movies. Mm-hmm. Stylistically trying to create something, you know, that we had an opportunity to do because it was a studio movie on a scale and trying to make something that was sort of like, I guess, between two different worlds in a way, you know, that movie. And then when you go to Iceland, it's just so stunningly beautiful.
Good Lord.
And I think what Steve was writing about was, you know, life experience and how life experiences, you know, going out and doing something can change your state of mind, can change, you know, how you feel. And I think that's what he was going for in writing it, was trying to, you know, shoot for amazing images. So that was sort of the goal, I think. And it always comes out of the writing.
And then when you get to a movie like a show like Severance, clearly it must be the collaboration between the art direction and the costumes and the director. You guys have it's the most
the coordination between those
beautiful.
Departments must have been amazing. I mean, did you guys meet together? How did that? I've just never seen everything like that.
Thanks, man. I mean, first of all, Sarah Edwards, who did Walter Mitty, did our costumes on Severance.
Oh, really?
And and we hadn't worked together since. And I was really excited to come back with her. And, you know, she has such an amazing eye for color, and collaboration between departments is so important.
I mean, you
production
can see
design,
it.
Costume, and our
especially
and Jessica. Yeah, Jessica, our cinematographer. I mean, that, I think it's everybody kind of going for something and sort of, you know, heading towards something that you don't quite know what it's going to be, but you talk about it and you look at different images and look at different movies and shows and things. But ultimately then you kind of, what was in the writing, what Dan Erickson wrote was so original.
Jesus.
So original. And I thought, and yet it reminded me of so many things that I loved. So it was sort of like trying to figure out a way to allow those ingredients to be a part of it and then let it be its own thing too.
Yeah, the letting go aspect of it, I'm wondering that line near the end of Walter Mitty where Sean Penn is saying, sometimes I don't take the picture, sometimes I allow the moment to be just for me or just for the world. Was that always in the script, or was that something that felt like it came very much from the heart from you? There are those moments.
No, that's pure Steve Conrad.
Wow.
Steve, you know, he really figured out, I think, in that story that what it was about in terms of finding your life, finding experience in the moment of your life, you know, really being present. And I mean, I think about that line and I think, God, I don't know, because like, for me, I want to capture everything,
right.
Try to, my memory, I don't try, like we're talking about memory. It's like, I want to have that moment, picture it, because I want to be able to go back and re-experience it.
That's Meredith takes pictures of everything. She wants it all recorded.
Well, everything. I mean, even with Alice, I always am taking her pictures like, Mom, stop. I'm like, this is from, I want this. Yeah. I want to keep this. This is not about you. Let me have this moment. I want to just hold on to it because I don't know if I'm going to remember this. You look at my phone and there's 50,000 pictures of her. Like, it's insane. But
I'm with you. I'm totally with you on that.
I want to have it. I want to keep it forever.
And when she's 20, you're going to look back and go, oh my goodness, look at that.
And I say that to her too. I'm like, when you're older, you're going to love these pictures. Like, anytime she and Patton are cute together, I'm like, capture.
But it's true. It's true. Like, my kids love looking at pictures of themselves. I mean, it's, and we go back, you go back that time. So that character is a very evolved character, and the message of, just enjoy the moment, be there. That's,
right.
Of course, but for me, the image is actually about movies. That makes me think about movies, because I think about this a lot lately too. Movies do capture, we're lucky enough to be in movies and to do things where you capture this scene, this this moment, it's recreated or whatever, but like, it exists there and you go back and you can watch it forever. I'm fascinated with that, watching old movies. I can just, watching a scene with Jimmy Stewart, or because I'm thinking like, what was that like on the set? What was going on in that day?
Yes.
But look what they created in that moment, and it's here and it's so alive, and it's, you can always go back to it. That's why I think people have this connection with movies that they love, and TV shows. It's like, there's a really deep emotional connection that you have with this stuff.
Well, especially now, and I'm going to get to your transition from film to TV, which it's not just you. So many great directors have realized that TV right now is Hollywood in the early 70s. It is the best time to be making stuff for TV. But I used to do a lot of punch up for the Farrelly brothers. I punched up Me, Myself, and Irene, and Shallow Hal, and the Heartbreak Kid. We did all that.
Right.
And I remember them, we were on a break one day, and they were talking about, and this gets into how you, I think, a lot, what you're talking about directing and letting go. They're like, they just out of nowhere, they started, and I'm not trying to embarrass you, but they really started singing your praises and said, that movie, as good as Kingpin was for us, Something About Mary was the first movie where we really worked with an actor who was like, Ben was game for anything, to the point where we couldn't believe what he was saying yes to because our instincts are so whack. And a lot of actors are like, yeah, excuse me, I'm not doing that. And you're, no, fuck you. And you were like, sure, I'll get my nuts caught in the, you know, we're going to show the nuts? Yeah, sure. And they were like, wow, he's going to, Ben Stiller's going to do his, okay. And
I didn't think they, first of all, I didn't think they were going to show the nuts because they had that oversized prop on the set yep. when we were shooting that, which was of the nuts.
Yep.
And it was like an oversized, it was like three times or no, like maybe like five times lifetime, life size, right?
Yeah.
Like huge. It was so weird. Oh and I see it on the set. I'm like, you're not going to use that. You're not going to use yeah. that. And they're like, yeah, no, no, we're going to do it. We're going to do it.
but that idea of, well, let's try it. Let's just try it. And then we'll see if it works later. That kind of attitude, I think a lot of directors need that. And a lot of them don't. I think a lot of them get done directing the film before they direct the film. And then they're yeah. so closed off to new ideas on the set. And so hearing them say that about you, like they would be doing a scene and they would get what they wanted, but then go, what if we tried this? And you go, yeah, what if we, let's see what happens. And so that kind of attitude, did you keep that when you went into directing, like kind of kept that mindset?
Yeah. I mean, my memory of doing that movie was that I actually was sort of like questioning them a lot of the time.
Wow, that's not what they said to me. They could not believe no. how happy they were with you.
No, but because they had such a different way of working, and I was like kind of coming at it more from like, well, you know, like this character, would he do that? You know, like, well, yeah, but when the dog like runs and, you know, like jumps in on you, you know, like we just want to make sure it looks like it's really attacking him. Okay, but why am I like, why does the dog not like me? You know, like it was like, I was getting into that. Yeah. And I think that we had a back and forth in that way that was ended up helping both of us because, you know, I would ask them questions they wouldn't think about. And then they would say, well, we just think this is going to be funny. And I'd be like, okay, well, let's give it a try. And I was constantly trying to sort of navigate with that with them. But when I read that script, I was like, this is hilarious. This movie is so funny.
Oh, yeah.
So, I got that there's a certain commitment level that you have to have. And you really appreciate that as an actor when you're, I mean, as a director, when you're working with actors who are willing to be game.
Yeah.
And so I tried to be aware of that working with them. It's like, okay, you know, and that's what directing is. It's subjective. So they're going to do it differently than I would do it. And so I want to give them the best chance of this thing working for them in terms of how they see it. I think that's part of just everybody wanting the movie to be good. Then, and you know, and there is that thing where you just know, okay, if it doesn't work, you know, they will cut it out.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in on the edit at all of that movie, but I, you know, you have to trust that these guys are going to, you know, go with what works for them for the movie.
I saw it in the theater, and for all the massive laughs in that movie, and there are huge laughs in that we can, you know, the hair gel scene and the pork and bean scene. But one of the biggest laughs comes after, at the end of the movie, when you do the right thing and go, none of us deserve Mary. We're all scumbags here. We've all been lying and being horrible, and you let her go. And then they cut to you walking down the street away from her, and you are full on sobbing, not comedic, like drama, Oscar clip sobbing. And because you took it so seriously, it got such a huge laugh because the movie's been so goddamn absurd. And then they cut to the most dramatic scene, which made it even funnier that you absolutely committed to having this nervous breakdown on camera. That's you and the Farrelly brothers going, oh no, if you're going to cry, I actually cry here.
It's insane.
Oh my God.
You're so talented, Ben. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
That was just life experience too, because yeah. it was like, all right, in this situation, which I've been in,
uh-huh.
this is how I felt. And I think they totally, you know, I don't remember exactly shooting that scene. I kind of remember though that, you know, that Peter being really supportive, like, yeah, yeah, you should just really go for it.
Oh, it's an ugly cry. It is not. Oh my God. It is. It's immediately douche chilling. And because it's so uncomfortable, everyone exploded laughing because they're like, wow, this movie has grinded every gear that it possibly can on the emotional spectrum. It did not hold back. That made me so happy. So happy.
Are you feeling like you have equal love for both acting and directing right now? Are you focusing more on feeling like I want to just focus on directing, or is it's all open for you? Like whatever you.
That's a good question. I think, you know, I haven't been acting for a while. I've gone for like 4 or 5 years now without really acting. And I never thought I'd take that long off. And I appreciate acting now, having not done it for a long time. I'm like, oh, I'd like to get back to doing that because it's fun. I mean, you talk about doing scenes like that. I'm like, oh, that was really fun to do. But I love directing. And oh, yeah. I really,
so on
Dana Mora, finally got to take myself out of the picture because I'd always in my head, yeah, I direct and I act, but you know, I always saw myself as a director, but I always somehow ended up in the movies I was directing, except for Cable Guy. And so this on Dana Mora, the first day of shooting, I was like, this is so great. Because I don't have to get in front of the camera. I can do one thing. Yeah. I can just fully invest in this. And the more I've done that, the more I've enjoyed it. So I really feel like I'm trying to figure my way back into acting and what that's going to be. But for right now, directing, you know, it's just totally takes everything for, you know, in terms of just creatively, it's so much fun to just totally invest in something. And you can really get into so many different areas of trying to figure out how do you make this thing be what you want it to be.
Well, you know? Well, your directing is truly phenomenal. Truly. Like yeah. You've become one of my very favorite directors of all time. Really.
Well, you guys are super. I mean, you're like, yeah, I mean, you guys are. I'm not going to say you're film snobs, but you're very, very choosy.
We have good taste in directors. Yes, and since I think you're my favorite now, I think you should be really happy about that.
Right. We're going to take a quick break and come back and do, I just want to do a little bit of Pat. I won't go too deep into Severance. I have some questions. We're not going to ruin anything. We'll be right back. All right. Hey, we're back. Ben Stiller, writer, director, extraordinaire, everything.
And a good man.
We didn't even bring up Zoolander, which is another one of those. You made one of the silliest comedies that weirdly predicted where the world was going to end up going in a weird way in terms of celebrity, in terms of, you know, what people would become obsessed with. I mean,
yes.
it is so weird. It predicts the Kardashians. It predicts
was Zoolander before the Kardashians?
It kind of was.
Yeah, it kind of was. And it really predicts the elevating of gorgeous stupidity. But by the way, good-hearted gorgeous stupidity. But someone who is just proud to not have a friggin' thought in their head. And that
dance, Derek. You're a monkey.
You're a monkey, Derek. Dance. I'm his photographer in one of the scenes, yelling
He's
at him.
So great.
Make him dress up like a monkey.
And Derek just does what you say.
Yeah,
he just does it.
He really does.
He's kind of in pain.
That's part of a great talk about go with things in that sequence where David Duchovny is explaining why male models are the perfect assassin. And again, the film styles when they showed Dealey Plaza, it's that wonderful Sears model with that kind of 60s film, and then and then at the end he explains the whole thing, and then apparently you riffed like, but why male models? And then there's that weird, and you use it. He goes, are you, because I just explained, like, he just didn't know what to do, and it's one of the
I think it was a mistake. I think I said the same line twice because I didn't realize I guess I wasn't listening in the scene as an actor, probably.
It is one of the biggest laughs in the movie. Of there's a weird, like, literally, they sit in silence for, like, 3 seconds, and he's like, are you serious? Because I just explained.
That's like the incredible Duchovny deadpan.
Yeah, just no reaction. and then also, I remember being at a table read for Civil War Land and Decline, which I think you were going to direct it, or what was that? Because that was a really interesting table read of another George Saunders. I love his writing, but he just seems like he'd be impossible to adapt.
Well, I think it's difficult to adapt his writing because it's so unique, and it's, you know, his writing style is so specific.
Yeah.
He's an amazing writer and his ideas are so, I mean, in terms of like ideas of where we're going as a culture and the way that he
I hope he's wrong about everything. God, I hope he is absolutely wrong. But after I read Escape from Spider Island, I'm like, Escape from Spider-Head. If he gets this one right, I'm done. I want off this planet.
I think, by the way, they just did that one. I think somebody tried to do that one and it's coming out.
Oh.
And you know, there have been a few attempts to do his his writing in as films or television. And yeah, it's a very specific tone. He's an amazing writer and person in terms of just listening to, if you ever can, like, you know, the addresses that he gives to students or, you know, just talking to him, he's got such a great point of view on life and, you know, and the writing process and the creative, the process of, you know, being creative.
Yeah.
But we tried for a long time and, you know, talk about a guy who's willing, like this guy is, you know, MacArthur Genius Grant level, you know, right. He's just an incredible writer. In the script writing process, he is always willing, when we've worked on Civil War Land, to go back in and try something new and reinvent. And, you know, he just has no ego about any of it because he's looking, and, you know, he looked at it working on that script as, okay, this is an exercise in me, you know, kind of learning how to write a script in this form because I haven't done this form. And he, yeah, he's incredible.
That the, in the original table read, your character dies and then addresses the camera after he's dead and basically challenges the audience, like, what are you, I'm dead, what are you doing with you? It is, it was one of the most brutal endings to a comedy. I mean, it's ostensibly a comedy and you leave, you, it's like, now go out and question your life.
Yeah, I think that's what they said at the studio when we tried to get it made, and that's why it never got made.
We're not doing
that. Actually saying exactly what the guy said.
You,
no,
have you written a book on, I feel like I need a book from you. I feel like I need a book, a memoir,
Janine,
but like slash
Janine
directing.
Wrote a parody book called...
We wrote a parody, Feel This Book.
Feel This Book.
Right.
Like one of those self-help Deepak Chopra kind of things.
Yeah.
But like Stephen King...
I don't know.
Stephen
I don't
King
have a desire
his,
to write a book right now. I mean, I
feel
I don't.
Like it would be helpful
I'm happy,
to the world.
Well, I'm... Thank you. I don't know.
To aspiring filmmakers.
Happy. Yeah, maybe something about that or the process of making stuff,
yeah,
I think, because it's good to hear, like the way you write the Jaws log or something like that.
Yeah.
Hearing somebody talk about the process can be really helpful. But on the George Saunders front, I mean, we're actually trying to do Civil War Land and Bad Decline after almost 30 years of trying to make
God.
That at HBO Max. We are in development with it as a claymation series.
What?
Amazing.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, well, then here, listen to my next question, which is, because Meredith was wondering, you know, do you miss acting? You're clearly in directing, but not only are you clearly full steam ahead directing, are you thinking of ever doing like a feature film again? Because you're thriving in this new landscape of TV where the best work is being done. I mean, it's like, I forgot who said it, but everyone talking about, well, the movie theater receipts are going down. That's because movies aren't doing what shows like Fargo and Severance and
Escape from Dannemora
and Watchmen and like and those shows are doing. You can get that at home now.
Well, you get to delve more and
yes.
It's longer. It's a film that you get to really get more detailed in.
No one's in a hurry. You really get to live with these characters. So are you in any hurry to get back to making stuff for, or like, do you want to play in this TV playground now?
The script dictates what the medium will be.
I really want to make a movie for sure. And I think it's such a complicated time right now for movies because what you're talking about is true, but I'm not sure what's the chicken or the egg in terms of what people want out there. I think it's what it's accepted right now as a feature in terms of what the studios will make.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like, and the pandemic has made it even more complicated.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea of what is going to draw people out from in front of their screens to go out to a movie now is, you know, it's a big question mark.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just seeing these bigger movies that are being considered as features. It's just the reality that people are not willing to put something like, if I could have made Escape at Dannemora as a feature, I would have. Because I love movies. Now, it probably would have been a 7-hour feature.
I can't imagine any scenes you could lose.
But for me, the experience of what I was always thinking about that and think about Severance the same way. I'm imagining myself watching it in a movie theater. That I honestly am, because that's the experience that I love the most.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, Severance, I think one of the things that made Severance even more effective and creepy is that not only would you watch it week to week, but after you would watch it, you would go back to your office job or you would go back to daily life and you would wonder how separated or connected am I? Like, even without the science fiction trappings to it, I started thinking, how often in my daily life do I shut myself off? Like, I just got to do this crap and then I'll do my creative stuff later. Like, this isn't my real life right now. And it's about how present are you. I cannot get over what a brilliant show Severance is.
But the exciting thing is with is being able to reach a lot of people through streaming.
Yes.
And, you know, and I think the other thing about Severance, the format of a series that's an open-ended series, and looking at that now as we're getting into season two, the story continuing, trying to figure out how to build off of that and what to delve into, that is something I've really never done before. So I'm really enjoying that part of it. Wow. But just cinematically, I'm always just thinking about stuff like as movies.
Well, it is cinematic. It's like a movie. Cinematic. You watch it doesn't feel like a TV show. It feels like the most gorgeous movie.
Yeah. Well, that thank you. I'm glad you feel that way, because that's what I want it to be, and that's what we all want it to be when we're making it. So that's what I imagine when we're, and it's going to be on a TV screen, it's going to be on an iPad or phone, whatever. Mm-hmm. You're just imagining it in the way that you see it. And I do feel grateful that the opportunities are there to do this kind of work right now in television.
Yeah.
I
rewatched the final episode of Severance when I was on the road on my iPad.
The best season finale I've ever.
But even on an iPad, it's even creepier. It actually adds a level of creepiness if you're sitting watching it on your iPad. Like, is this an amusement that was designated okay for me to watch by my superior? Like, there's so much sinisterness to this show. And again, just like how you are making these evolutionary leaps every time you direct, it's the fact that Patty Arquette, who is in Escape at Dannemora, and
she's
now
she's the greatest actress of our time. She's the next Meryl Streep right now.
She was always great, but she's also done incredible leaps in terms of the work she's doing. Like, how did you guys meet for Dannemora? And obviously you must have had her in mind for Severance.
Yeah, I mean, Dannemora, she was the idea, I think, that Michael Tolkien and Brett Johnson had talked about, who wrote Dannemora, that from when I got brought on.
I love Michael Tolkien, by the way. Love him.
Oh, yeah.
God, is he good.
He wrote The Player, and he's just,
Have you read his novel? He has a novel called N3. You just go read it.
I haven't read it. Oh,
God. It's classic Tolkien. It will just creep the crap out of you. And it's so well written. Anyway, sorry. Didn't mean to do that little song.
So those guys that were, Patty Arquette was the idea. And I was like, well, that would be great. I feel like, sometimes if there's a good idea, you just recognize it's a good idea,
And our friend Eric Lang plays her husband.
Oh my God.
Okay. Eric.
If anyone has transformed his physical appearance more.
I told him, we know Eric, we go to dinner with him. I love Eric. He was amazing in a movie, a series called Unbelievable as the cop. Yeah. And I loved him in that. So then we're watching Escape at Dannemora. And when he first came on screen, I was like, I think he might be going a little too far with this. And in my mind, I'm like, I think he's puffed up because he got so much attention from Unbelievable. Now he's doing this method bullshit. This is unnecessary.
And then you go and look at the
and
real guy.
And then when they show the real guy,
you're
I'm like
holy
oh
shit.
Oh my God.
Got him perfectly.
Like, that was, and again, that final shot of him, I'm like, he framed him like Bigfoot in the Gimlin Patterson film. You literally recreated. Yes, you did the Bigfoot, and you freeze framed in the same motion. That made me laugh so hard.
Did you do that? On
it wasn't. No, it was so funny because I didn't do that. I feel like he did that. I filmed the shot, and then I saw it, and I was like, oh, man, he's doing Bigfoot.
He's doing Bigfoot. What a character.
And then
it's
like, well, we got to do a freeze frame.
You freeze frame. It's the same classic freeze frame from the film, which I'm like, how would they do? But again, when we watched the final, when they showed the actual people, I'm like, oh, yeah, he is amazing. Yeah. I did not. I mean, but he went so far with it. It's incredible.
No, but he sent in a reading, a self-tape, and it was so accurate to this person. And I really felt like, wow, this guy's really committed. And he had a subtlety about it, too. That was, I think that last scene with him and Patricia when he goes to visit her, you just see this guy's humanity too. So, that's great. Actors can do that where they can be big and small at the same time. And
well, you find
Patty, by the way, on for Severance was just, I that thing of like going, okay, I think she would be great in this because she's an amazing actress. She could do anything, but you know, this is something maybe I haven't quite done before, she hasn't quite done before. And having that little degree of uncertainty of like pushing for something else and saying, I want to try this because I could imagine what it could be, but I haven't quite done it, is sometimes a good place to go to, because you're pushing yourself out there and you're taking some chances. And I really didn't know on Severance the whole time. I was excited making it. I was excited to see it because it was something I really wanted to see.
Yeah.
But as we were making it really up through the end, I didn't know if it was going to work for a general audience, because because it was one of those things where we just were so in it and we're like, you're committed to a certain thing that you're creating. And then you just hope people are going to connect with it.
And but they do. And it's spectacular. Yeah. And I'm so impressed with your career and the things you've been doing recently. And you're just beyond talented, but beyond that, like a wonderful person and a mensch and lovely. And
thanks, Mary.
I'm so happy that you...
Can I do every interview with you guys?
Yeah.
I just do every interview for everything.
But it's true. And we're both really proud of you and think you're great and love you and really happy
I love you guys too.
To do the podcast.
Well, really, really quickly, before we let you go, so you're working on season two of Severance now.
Yeah.
I just love how in the final episode, and if I'm not mistaken, I don't think John Turturro speaks in the finale. I don't think he ever speaks, which gets back to the, but you know everything he's thinking. It's the Benicio del Toro thing again. You know how to, it's amazing. It's,
I mean, I think chapter one in my on directing book would be hire great actors.
Yes. Yeah. That saves
seriously,
you, a lot of
you know, that's it. It's like, you know, yeah, he invests so much. He knew what that was. And, you know, you can read that in his face. And that wasn't easy stuff to do for an actor, to have to like go through a trunk of stuff and have to react to each different thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. Yeah. So I'm working on that, working on developing that with the whole team, with Dan Erickson and everybody. And, you know, working on trying to make a movie at some point. But, you know, that's sort of a process too.
And is what makes Sammy Run always going to be your white whale on the horizon, or will that ever be pulled in? Do you think?
I would like to pull it in. It's an amazing novel, Bud Schulberg. You know, there are a lot of issues that have faced that piece over the years, starting from when Bud wrote it and was sort of exiled out of Hollywood
because of who he was basically writing it about. The guy knew. He's like, oh, thanks, dude. And that, yeah, kind of ruined him for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, his father was running Paramount. Like he was, you know, he sort of bit the hand that fed him. And I think there's always been issues with it, you know, it's the Sammy Glick character, you know, and telling that story of a guy who's willing to do anything. And he's a Jewish character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a Jewish person, I'm aware of that too. And, you know, you want, but it's like a story that is beyond that. And I feel like it's worth telling, especially as it relates to the world we're in, the, you know, post Trump and post all of it. So hopefully someday.
Again, we have decades of stuff ahead from this guy. I can't believe I feel like Ebert. I feel like Ebert, when he like saw what Scorsese was doing, realized, oh my God, I have so much more stuff to watch from this guy. It's very exciting. I'm just saying
as an
annoying film fan, it's very exciting.
Well, I hope we can work together some more.
Oh, please. Again, anything. Yeah. I want to have a musical dance experience. Come on, man.
Yes.
Please.
I want to see that dance.
Well, thank you for being on the show. We adore you. And this was awesome. You are our 50th podcast.
50th guest.
Not guest.
Oh, 50th episode
of
the podcast.
It's like the fourth guest.
Yes.
We haven't had a lot of guests.
I am honored to be on your 50th episode.
Yes, we're happy to have you. All right, everybody. We will talk to you guys next Tuesday.
Next week, we have the second key grip from Glitter. So we'll be talking to him about a lot of his work. We are off and running with guests now. So, Ben, thanks for... We could not have gotten him if you hadn't done this. So thank you.
I've set the bar.
Oh, dude, thank you so much, man.
All right, see y'all later.
See ya.
Bye.
This podcast is a production of Meredith Salinger and Patton Oswalt.
In association with Starburns Audio. Executive producers are Cliff Dorfman and Jason Smith. And if you have questions for us, send them to...
Hey, did you get my text? @gmail.com. And don't forget, subscribe to this podcast. It's free, and it helps us get to keep making the show.
Starburns Audio, a podcast network.